can share your situation. Keeping hold on our emotions, they will only make us cry. And you go, I know, but you know it ain't so serious anyway. When the clouds arrive, we'll live on Ocean Drive. Don't know why it's so blue. The sun's gonna shine on everything you do. The sky. Gonna shine on everything you do. We left you black and blue without a word of explanation. And he took your love for granted, and he left you high and dry. But you know, sun's gonna shine on everything.
Did you hear that?
The sky is so blue. The sun's gonna
sun is going to shine on everything you do. Wow. That's what we need to hear, isn't it? Hello, and welcome to the Croaky 102.5 FM Soundar Radio. My name is Julie Mullen, and I'm broadcasting from Totnes, live on the air, on the airways. That was the Lighthouse Family and Ocean Drive. And that's going out especially to Di Levy today, who's over in her art studio creating havoc, I hope, but also deliriously wonderful paintings. So here's to you, Di Levy. And welcome to all our fantastic listeners in the Totnes and Dartington area. I'll be with you from 11 through to 12 today, and we have some great guests. So to those who've got online and are listening around the world, and we don't know who you are, but shout out if you are on the moor. Ooh, 16. What about if you are in Venezuela? Nobody. Okay, that's all right. But wherever you are, you know, giant hugs. So this is the House of Goodbye, bye-bye virus. We've been in the bunker all week. But, oh, God, that was the bunker. But look, we're back. That's just a shout-out to Martin, and because he's been through it, the mill, this week. But anyone who caught what went on in Glastonbury, here's Billy. Billy Eyelashes, I like to call her. This is going out to all the revelers, all the people that partied whilst we were stuck in bed. And Alistair, get better soon, Alistair Patterson.
For some time, can't stop staring at those ocean eyes. Burning cities and napalm skies.
Billie Eilish's, I call her Eyelashes. I remember Peter Sherman picking me up because I called her Billie English. That was a little while ago when I was a balm pot. If you just tuned in, this is 102.5 FM. I'm Julie Mullen. I'm broadcasting live from home in Totnes, Devon. And you're welcome. Join the party. And if you've got ocean eyes, even better. Now, talking about ocean eyes, Sarah Louise Connolly is our Fantasimondo inimitable roving reporter. She is, indeed. And she's been out on the streets of Totnes. But let's get her on the show. Come on, girl. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Coffee, come on, Sarah. Come on, Sarah Louise.
You put the beans, goddammit, in the grinder. You put the beans in the grinder. You pop the beans up inside the grinder. You grind it up. And then you put a little grounds in the filter. You put the coffee down in the Ooh. Filter. And then you put the filter up in the top of the coffee maker. Gotta get that drip. Gotta drip, 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 a drip, a drip, a drip, drip, drip. Got to drip, a drip, a drip, drip, drip. Gotta drip, baby, drip. Then you put it in your cup.
So here I am, the roving reporter Sarah Connolly, and I'm here with a mocha and some pastries in a bribe for 5 minutes of this very busy, talented lady's time. And here she is, it's Julia Christine Wilson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, between bites of croissant, I want to ask you about the world of body art and wearable art, because you are a tattoo artist.
I am.
At Divine Ink, which is at the top of Totnes, so I didn't have to rove too far. Rove, is that a word?
Roam
too far today. So how did you get into the world of tattooing?
It's a very good question. I think I started kind of becoming aware of heavily tattooed people when I started getting into punk music and stuff. And then off the back of that, I started getting tattoos, and then off the back of that, I just fell in love with the atmosphere of being in a studio and just loved it. And then I was always quite artistic growing up, so it seemed like a really perfect job for me to have, because you don't have to wear a uniform, you can do art daily, and every day is different, you know, it keeps me on my toes.
And the training is quite intense though, isn't it? It's actually really quite hard. I mean, I came into the studio a few weeks ago,
yep.
And your assistant was tattooing a grapefruit,
yep.
Which surprised me. So tell me all about the world of grapefruits.
Well,
how
they sit very still. I'll give them that much. Yeah.
But this is obviously because you can't just go practicing tattooing on anybody.
Well, I mean, it's good to have some kind of idea of the weight of the machine, the vibrations, just like the awkwardness of working on something that's not a flat piece of paper. So it's just... And also, she's vegan, so we don't really want, you know, pig skin in the studio.
Right.
And grapefruits smell lush when they're getting tattooed.
So, how long have you been doing this?
God, it's got to be 17, 18 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. Do you think that this has affected your style?
Perhaps, yeah. I think, especially when it comes to more kind of painterly stuff, I had the chance of doing kind of oriental artwork and more brushstrokey stuff before the whole watercolour tattoos became quite popular. So yeah, I definitely think it's influenced aspects of my art.
And are there any particular artists that you yourself, like, you fangirl, like, you follow on Instagram, that, like, any particular names that you like, oh wow, they're just like the best?
There's a few, yeah. I mean, I think, to be honest, it was before Instagram that I started becoming really aware of artists that I really liked, and so it was more through tattoo magazines and, like, you know, the old school kind of way of finding out about people.
So
before,
give us a name. Who?
I love Jimmy Litwalk's stuff. He's amazing. He's done my throat tattoo, so I was really, really eager to get booked in with him when he was doing a spot in London.
Oh wow.
And the person that he works with, Joe Capobianco, I really like his stuff. A lot of it's like bright, colourful, kind of fun stuff.
And some people call you a magician for your cover-up jobs.
Yeah.
I personally do.
I sold my soul to the devil. That's my secret.
So you do these cover-up tattoos for people. Now, this is when maybe you've had a tattoo that you regret, like your ex-boyfriend's name. Or maybe you've got scarring from an accident or from self-harm or something. This must be one of the most rewarding parts of the
definitely,
job.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's so nice to be able to give someone something they love. I mean, I've tattooed people who've got, you know, a bad tattoo or some scarring, and the clothes shop, they'll find stuff that does not show that part of the body ever.
Yeah.
And then they leave the studio like, I'm going to go get a backless dress.
Well,
I personally
was nearly in tears, wasn't I, when I came in to see
you.
I was like...
Yeah, it's so nice. I mean, it's nice to do anyone's tattoo because there's so much trust involved, and it's nice to give them something that they're going to wear forever and be happy with. But
when you're fixing something that they really, really dislike, you just get that extra kind of like,
and
you know.
Yeah. And have you done nipples and things for like mastectomy patients and stuff? That must be really rewarding.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great honour, to be honest, yeah.
And as an artist, because this is art, this is really is art, do you get much of a chance for a completely free rein on design, or is it quite restricted? Do you find yourself like holding yourself back because of what the client
wants? Bit of both. It depends. I mean, obviously, I'm going to work to what the client wants. And if somebody comes in and they want something that I genuinely don't feel that I could do justice, like it wouldn't look good, it just won't work, they want it too small or too much stuff involved and too much detail, I will tell them that. I'm not going to just do whatever they tell me to do. But at the same time, you don't want just completely free reign, because I don't know this person well enough to just win it, you know? So it's nice to have a bit of an idea of what they want, what their budget is, the placement, and then it's also nice to have a bit of free reign so that you can really do your best work.
So what is the oldest person you have ever tattooed?
I believe she was 83.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What did she have done?
She had, her partner had just passed away and he hated tattoos. So it wasn't long after he passed that she booked in with me, because she's always wanted one.
Like little act of rebellion.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Her punk rock side coming out. But she got a really beautiful blue tit, and it was a decent size. It was, you know, the size of a hand on her thigh, and she sat like an absolute rock. And then actually, I tattooed her daughter yesterday, and she got two blue tits. So I don't know if she's trying to one-up
me. Yes, come on, you've got to multiply.
I'll take your tattoo
tits
and double it, yeah.
So what are the pros and cons of being a tattoo artist for any budding artists out there that are wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Pros is that it's an absolutely incredible job. I love my job to bits. And like I said, every day is so different. And you do get to, you know, do artwork every single day. But the cons are, it's very rare that you have enough time to do just artwork that isn't tattooing or tattoo design based. It's a very all in, like, consuming job. Like, you're not at work ever. Like, if I'm not tattooing, I'm doing designs for someone. If I'm not doing designs for someone, I'm doing admin. I'm speaking to clients. I'm booking people in. Like, it's never ending.
Do you find, like, people come up to you in the pub? Because it's like, I think you're, like, 24 hours. Yeah. So they're like, yeah. I'm thinking about... Yeah. Drunk people come up to you and say, I'm thinking about
this. It happens a lot. And you're like, you have to kind of be like, drop me an email. If you still want this tomorrow, drop me an email.
Right, well, that's it. I'll let you get back to your next client.
Wonderful. Thank you for my pastries and my coffee.
That's all right. I bribed her here. She's got a pan au chocolat. She's got croissant, she's got raisins, she's got the whole shaboodle here. And this is the Roving Reporter signing off. Thank you very much. Back to you in the studio, Julie.
Yeah, you put the coffee, put the beans up in the grinder.
Okay.
You put the beans, goddammit, in the grinder.
Get the coffee.
You put the beans in
the
grinder.
I need the coffee.
You put the beans up inside the grinder, you grind it up. And then you put a little grounds in a filter. You put the coffee down in the filter. And then you put the filter up in the top of
Mark
the coffee.
Mark Ribéry, supporting Sarah Louise Connolly. Chatting with Julia Christine Wilson. Oh my God, I laughed through that. That was brilliant, Sarah Louise Connolly and Julia Christine Wilson of Divine Ink in Totnes. I haven't got a tattoo, I'll be honest with you, but after listening to that, I'm thinking, ooh, I've got some ideas. So thank you for bringing that to our earlobes. Ah, wonderful. So today on the programme, and if you've just tuned in, hello, this is Julie Mullen in Totnes. I'm sort of over vamping that because last week I actually forgot who I was. I was just about at the beginnings of the coronavirus. So I think I eventually said, oh, this is blah, blah. But you have tuned in to the right station. It is 102.5 FM. And a big wave out there to the man in the studio himself, Chris. Hello there over there. Are you okay? Are you fine? Before we have Laura Horton, who is stepping into rehearsal space today on her show called Breathless. And because it's day one of rehearsals, she couldn't be here live, but we've got a fabulous pre-record for you, which I know you're going to enjoy. Meantime, let's have a little bit. Should we have... I think I know who has to come here. Come on, John. Come on, darling. Imagine, okay?
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Marvellous John Lennon and Imagine, taking us up to our interview with Laura Horton, who's Laureate of Words in Plymouth. And later on in the programme at 11:45, we'll be talking to the fantastic Wonder Zoo, who are also based in Plymouth. I seem to have discovered Plymouth. I love Plymouth. Oh my goodness. So also, just to say a huge thank you to John Elliott. Martin went off to the Bay Horse to see him perform live, and he was sensational. And Martin took a little video, and we've asked permission to use a part of John's song as our intro to the Laura Horton interview. So thank you, John Elliott. Let's get it done. Let's play it.
When the world understands me, then my life will be in misery. I think the greatest thing about people is that nobody's quite the same as everybody. Everybody's different. Nobody is the same. Everybody's different. Nobody is the same. Shibidua. Different.
Hello.
Hello. This is 102.5 FM Sound Art Radio. I'm delighted to introduce Laura Horton, who is our Laureate of Words from Plymouth. Hello and welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited about your title. Can you share with our lovely listeners how this all came about?
Yeah, so I was sent the link to the laureateship to apply by, it was either my mum or it was a friend, and I was just thinking, no, it was like the day before the application deadline, and I sort of ummed and ahed about it, because at that point I wasn't sure whether to move back to London or stay in Plymouth, because I grew up here. Mm-hmm. And I'd obviously been here through the pandemic, but I just thought, well, there's no harm in putting in an application. And then I just kept getting through the next process and the next process, and then it came down to three of us and a public vote, and then I won it. And then I'd made the decision that if I won it, I would commit to being in Plymouth, and I would settle here and try and buy a flat, which I did. And so I'm kind of a year and a half into the role now, which is absolutely crackers. It's gone so quickly, I think because of the pandemic, and sure, I haven't been able to sort of do things as I might like to. But I've been in and out of schools sort of teaching. I've been responding to commissions that I've been given from different organisations in the city, and sort of trying to get out there as the first playwright laureate and the first woman in the role, actually, and just shine a light on theatre.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's just brilliant to hear this. It really is. It's music to my earlobes. And just the whole process as well. It sounded a bit nail-biting, but what I love about it, Laura, is also the fact that you allowed fate to guide you, that if I, you know, get this, you know, laureateship, then I'll stay in Plymouth. I'm rather taken by that sort of life direction, because I sort of let it rule my life like that too. So I met you most recently at Wonder Zoo in Plymouth, and I was very pleased to make a proper connection rather than just a Facebook connection. And you sent me a link to your film, A Summer of Birds. Is that correct? That's the title of it, isn't it?
I did, yeah.
And I have to say, I was really bowled over. I played a little bit of it on our programme last week on Monday. And actually, just even that tiny bit of clip, the very start of your film, kind of made me very emotional. So I think you achieved a lot in 20 minutes, a 20-minute short. Can you give me a little bit of the background on how you came to make that film?
Yeah, it was quite random, actually. It was in 2020, and I'd applied for Plymouth Fringe. I think it was the end of the year before, and I'd got a place to present a play. So I'd sort of written this play called Labyrinth Diet that I was gonna produce for Plymouth Fringe, and then the pandemic happened, and Plymouth Fringe decided that they obviously couldn't do anything live, but they said they would do a digital version, but everyone had to reapply, either with, you know, a different idea to do it digital. And I just thought, I don't actually want to just do a Zoom reading of this play. I'd rather try and make a film. So I just came up with the idea really quickly, because I was with my parents in the pandemic, and there was a seagull that we called Erica, and Erica had a broken wing, and she was never going to be able to fly. We knew that. And she used to waddle up like twice a day to our patio and watch the sunset, and we'd feed her some sardines, and then she'd waddle back. And it really moved us. I think it was because it was you know, about fragility, I guess. It reminds you of your own fragility, and seagulls are normally quite terrifying, but Erica definitely was not. She was quite vulnerable as well. So I just thought, I need to write about Erica. So that was where the idea came from. And I literally had 3 weeks to write it, cast it, find someone to direct it, shoot it, edit it, find the music, on a budget of £250.
Well, then you are superwoman.
Last minute. But it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience.
I think that sometimes when those creative doors fling open, it doesn't matter if you had £2.50, it would happen, because there's something, there's a force that I feel that is in intermingled with kind of destination. And I think that clearly, you know, you made contact with an actress. I think you said, you mentioned to me that you contacted Holly Kavanagh via Twitter. Can you tell me, did you know about her?
No, I'd never met her at all. So I put a call out on Twitter, just trying to find local actors. Yeah. And Holly had come back from London to stay with her mum. And she doesn't use Twitter. Someone had seen it and contacted her and said, join Twitter and contact Laura. And so she did. And so I saw a number of people, but she just stood out to me for the role. And so we got her on board, and then we've become very good friends, as the same as with the director and the woman that shot it, Heather Passfield. So she's a great friend of mine too. I think maybe doing something like that quite intensely after a period of isolation brought us together.
Definitely.
In a really lovely way.
Yeah, well, it has a lovely weight to it, that film, and very much about fragility and just the whole concept that you managed to convey that in 20 minutes. But of course, you had great help, because not only obviously you had a very good script, film script, but you had the music, which I thought was very compelling. And who directed it, by the way?
So Heather Passfield directed it, but I sort of helped. So we knew that time was so limited, so we both fed into shots, and we sort of went around together and picked the places that we wanted to do it. And then we edited it together over 5 very intense days, like morning to night.
Oh, God. I mean, you must feel like it's your baby, do you?
Yeah, no, it was such a lovely thing. It's weird looking back at it now, because it feels like a long time ago, and also we made loads of mistakes making that film, so I can see things that I'm like, oh no, next time. But actually I think that's so important, just to do it sometimes and make the mistakes for the next film, because I think sometimes you spend so much time looking for funding and you can psych yourself out, I think, trying to make it perfect. And sometimes it's just better to do it quickly.
I think so.
So I'm really glad we did.
Oh, God, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of films and a number of shorts, and I found it really compelling. And actually, there's nothing in my mind that is glaringly there's nothing, honestly, I can say that, oh gosh, that really stands. Mind you, I think everybody is pretty particular, because a friend of mine who I met many years ago during sort of comedy impro times, she's just recently made a film, and she sent it to me, and she said, oh, there's this bit that you can see the dog fluff coming into it. Oh, it's just horrible. You'll see it really stands up. And I watched it twice, and I couldn't see, like, Fran, I can't see anything. And again, it was a very good film. So, you know, I think it is all about taking opportunities and running with them. And, you know, you've met all these contacts now. And I thought that Holly Kavanagh was really strong in the role. I mean, she has got this compelling vulnerability, but also comedic feel about her. Nothing is thrown away, and yet everything is thrown away in many respects, but she is I just think, you know, that's an actor that's really going places. So I think you're incredibly fortunate to have well, you chose really, really well, obviously. So now I know that you are very busy, and you are in with plans off to Edinburgh, to the festival, but obviously before you get to the festival, you have to enter the rehearsal stages for a brand new play. Laura, tell me about this brand new play and when it starts rehearsing. Is it Monday?
Yes, it's Monday. So we're going on Monday, which is terrifying. So it's a play that I've written called Breathless. And I started it last year. So the Theatre Royal had approached me and said, did I want to present 3 20-minute plays? I'd already written quite a few, and so I picked a three-hander and a two-hander that I'd written. The second one had been commissioned by The Space in London already for Zoom, so I rewrote that for the stage, and I knew I wanted a monologue for the third piece, but I hadn't written it, and the director really needed it quickly, so I had a couple of hours to write a monologue. And so I just wrote something very personal, because it felt like that's the only thing I could do. I didn't have time to research. So I wrote this monologue about a woman moving back to Plymouth. She's a hoarder, and she's dating, and she starts dating women for the first time in her late 30s, sort of having repressed her bisexuality. And it went down really well, and I had really beautiful comments from audience members and people coming to say that they felt they might hoard too, and I had some great conversations. And then the Theatre of Plymouth approached me and said I should think about applying for the Theatre Royal Plymouth Pleasance regional partnership to take the show to Edinburgh.
Wow.
So I applied and I had to do an interview, and then I won that partnership. And then, of course, I had to write the play. It's a 60-minute play. And I'd already sort of started that process. So it's basically that version, but I've just gone into more detail and elongated it. And so it's very personal. Not all of it is based on me. Obviously, there are fictionalized characters. Nobody in it is real apart from me. And there are some conversations I have with my mum and dad that they're happy for me to have left in there. But it's kind of a dark, it's not a comedy, but there's humour in it. And so I'm going into rehearsals on Monday with Madeline McMahon and Stephanie Kempson as director in Plymouth. And so we're going to be presenting it at Theatre Royal Plymouth from the 20th to the 23rd of July, and then taking it up to Edinburgh for the month.
Oh, I definitely want to come and see
really
it.
Exciting.
Oh, God, it's so exciting. It's just brilliant. Is this your first play in Edinburgh?
Yeah, so I've been to Edinburgh for, 6 or 7 years as a publicist. So I'm used to sort of running around with 12 shows, trying to like chivvy journalists into shows. So this will be my first year as a playwright, but I'm also producing the show with Theatre or Plymouth. They're a co-producer now. So it's going to be terrifying and different. It'll be busy, but different.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of quite excited to be in Edinburgh as an artist, not a publicist.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yes, definitely. Although, you know, it's amazing what talents that we've all sort of build up over the years and how, you know, PR or whatever it is you're involved in. Probably, let me ask you the question, actually. Do you think that you got into PR, but really in the backdrop of your mind, you thought, actually, I'm a playwright, but I'm in PR? Or did it not occur to you? What's the score with that?
I wanted to be a writer since I was a child. Mm. And actually, when I was little, my mum and dad bought me this beautiful little theatre. And I used to put on theatre shows with my brother when I was about 5 or 6. And my brother would always make fart noises and absolutely ruin it. And I would make my family pay me 50 pence a ticket.
I like you. You're good.
So that was obviously, there was an instinct for that then. But I always thought I would be a novelist. And my mum had her first book published when she was 50.
Wow.
And so I sort of thought I would maybe try and follow in her footsteps. And I tried to get into journalism as well. I sort of thought that I would be a journalist, novelist.
Mm.
And then you had to work unpaid in London for free. Because I was wanting to get into fashion journalism to start with. And I just couldn't do it. So I moved back to Plymouth and I got a job as an usher and a shredder at the Theatre Royal. And then eventually this job in PR as a PR assistant came up. So I did fall into it. But I really love PR. I still do it. I think it's very underappreciated as a skill. And also it sort of, it is storytelling, because you're finding things within, you know, when I work with artists, I'm finding out about them and their personality and how we can use that if they feel comfortable. And I'm finding little stories within the subject matter, but also around the creative team and what's going on in the news, and trying to create links and finding other shows to work with. So it's very, it's really served me well, actually. I didn't realise how useful a skill that would be, and also all the connections that I've made doing that over the last 15 years have been really invaluable. But I always knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew there was more there as well in terms of creativity. I'd always loved painting, and I was a creative person, and I just repressed it. I feel like I was sort of a flower turned in on myself a bit. And I remember I'd meet up with my friend Trish, and she wanted to desperately be an actor. And we were sort of like, oh, we really want to do these things, and we don't know how to go about even starting doing them.
Oh,
and it hadn't actually occurred to me to try and be a playwright, even though I was working in theatre.
Yeah.
I just never really saw many plays by women. There weren't that many on. It would tend to be Shakespeare, or you might get, you know, a Carol Churchill play, obviously, because she's exceptional. But it was very rare to see new writing by women and newer writers. So I didn't really think that that was an option. And it wasn't until I turned 30 odd that I started exploring playwriting. And I'm 38 now, so it's only just sort of taking off. So it's taken many, many years to get to this point.
I appreciate what you said very much, because I think you're right that no matter what sort of it is that you're involved in, and that it's, I loved what you said about PR. And I remember years ago when I was, I hadn't got the place at Webber Douglas, but I was sort of wanting to train at Webber Douglas drama school. And my sister sort of said, well, you could go into PR, you know, instead of, so if you're not successful at Webber Douglas, you can go into PR. It seemed to be that was her thought of, you know, me. And I was very sort of, how dare you suggest that I go into PR? It was almost in my head a dirty word. And actually, what you're saying to me is that it's so canny of you. Well, I know you sort of fell into it, but actually, do you know what I find most of the time? And I'm saying it about myself, because I am really rubbish at PR and marketing in terms of putting things out there. You know, I'll wait on things for ages and ages and ages. But, you know, so I could do with a crash course in PR, but that, by the way, to be a playwright and to have that ability, but the backdrop of your mind and other, you know, directional things you can sort of hit on, you know, to actually have that chiming in is utterly fantastic, as most people, because what resonated with me very strongly was when you said, you know, my friend wanted to be an actor and I wanted to be a writer, but we didn't know how to go about it and we didn't realise. And then as you described the stepping stones into your actual sort of how your reality of how you found your life path, if you like. I just love all of that because I find it really exciting that, you know, those doors. I mean, although 8 years seems a long time, it doesn't in my mind. I think I always believe in right timing. And I think that you feel very right time. This is feeling like is it Saturn return? I know nothing of it, but I just quite like saying those words. It's your Saturn return. You know, it is true that kind of, I think when I look back in my life, sort of there've been key moments. So when I did get a place at Webber Douglas, it was like, oh my God, this is my dream come true. Yeah. But it does take a really long time, even after leaving Webber Douglas without a theatrical agent. You know, it took me ages to get a really strong, you know, strong representation. But I think if you stick with it, you know, this is what I've really learned through life, that, you know, it's so easy. I could give up everything. You know, a drop of a hat. Oh, I'm giving it up. I'm giving it up. Oh, I'm giving it up. How many times I say it to myself. But actually, the truth is, it's that resilience, that strength, that inner core that you just have to keep on going. No, keep on going, whatever. But, I mean, to me, it feels like, you know, the pleasance and the play and you're stepping into rehearsals on Monday. Sounds like you have a great team behind you. And then this whole month in Edinburgh to be actually entering into Edinburgh with that energy of a playwright. When you meet people in the Pleasance Courtyard and you're having your glass of whatever, Prosecco or something marvellous, like fizzy water or whatever, you can say, I'm a playwright. But yeah, you know, it's going to be really thrilling because you'll be mingling with other writers and performers, and I just love Edinburgh. I mean, it's very hard. I think Edinburgh is incredibly difficult. Having said that, it's so liberating and fabulous. So I'm really kind of, I'm terribly jealous that you're going without me, but I shall be living vicariously through you. Now, we are coming out of time shortly, but I wanted to get one more question in, which is about your mum and dad, because you mentioned your mum having her first novel at 50, and also the fact that they bought you this little theatre. And I thought, oh,
yeah,
I like these parents. Would they adopt me? And then, of course, the idea for the film coming from, you know, your experience with the little birdie, beautiful seagull, and the fragility of that bird and the way that the broken wing. Tell me just very briefly about your mum and dad. How would you describe them?
They're so lovely. My mum and dad are wonderful, very close to them both. My mum and dad were both teachers. My mum is from Tredegar in South Wales. My dad's from Plymouth. And my dad he's really into culture, but he's not super creative. I mean, I think everyone is creative, but he doesn't have an interest in writing and things like that, but he likes going to things. And my mum has always been a writer. She's written since she was young and was really interested in philosophy and different things. So she's very creative, and so we really connect on that level. We're writing something together at the moment, actually, which is lovely. And so from a young age, there was always an encouragement of, you know, being creative and going to the theatre when we could. I remember my mum taking me to Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day when I was little. And so they've just always made it very clear that they would be supportive and happy for me to do what I needed to do, which is really remarkable. And my dad's just a big feminist as well. Like, doesn't, you know, just sort of quietly is really encouraging and very kind. They're both very kind and supportive, And obviously, you know, they're my biggest champions. They were running around today trying to find a copy of Death and Life because I'm in it.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting.
They're just lovely people. Very warm, very funny, very kind people, and very lucky. And I'm very conscious that, you know, not everyone is born into that. And a lot of the work that I do in the laureateship is trying to encourage young children to be creative, because I don't think that all kids think they can be.
No, you're absolutely right. And on that note, I just want to say thank you, Mum and Dad, for making Laura Horton. What a fantastic interview. Laura Horton, thank you so much for being on our show today, and all the very best with rehearsals. We're coming up to that time. Wonder Zoo are going to be coming on soon, but let's have Still Into You. Well, we thought we were. Here they come. Still Into You, and that's Paramore. This is Julie Mullen, and it's 102.5 FM. It's time to call Wonder Zoo in Plymouth. Are you ready? I hope so. We're going to find out what goes on with Wonder Zoo. Hello.
Hello
there, good Hello. Morning to Hi. You. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Welcome.
I'm not very great with technology, so it's like, oh, it's actually working.
Welcome to the show. We're really delighted to have you on the programme. Now, can you just explain who you are and what you do?
So I'm Slane McGough Davey, and I run a kind of like performance combined arts platform in Plymouth called Wonder Zoo, which is centered around word, and that can take any form and shape whatever it wants to be. It could be comedy, it could be like poetry, it could be music, as long as it's got a word in it. It could even be a dog talking. I've had a dog on stage before doing a poem, which the audience was shocked about because he was barking. I had to translate the actual poem from the dog.
Oh my God. No wonder I have got a fixation about Wonder Zoo. That's completely, you're talking to a convert now. I mean, you tell me everything you need to tell me. I'm in love with Wonder Zoo. I've had a look at your website and you seem to have a lot of investors and followers, and you clearly have big determination to get this Wonder Zoo out there. Tell me how it all began once upon a time. You and what happened? How did Wonder Zoo begin?
So yeah. I was a student in the city 9 years ago when the British Art Show first came to Plymouth. So the British Art Show, funny enough, is back in Plymouth this year.
Brilliant.
And so I had to do something to get past my master's. You know, your student, like, oh my God, there's deadlines coming up. You've got to do something. So I created at the time a magazine called Tribe,
okay,
which went online and had huge amounts of followers. But I wasn't really satisfied with creating an online magazine. So I ended up sort of creating a kind of group called PCQ Arts at the time, where it's a weird name, I know, Penny Come Quick Arts, it's a bit weird, but there's a place in Plymouth called that. And it was like art in houses. So imagine raves in houses, but with people coming to houses for art.
Ooh.
So people would be doing belly dancing, showing off paintings, doing poetry inside someone's front room. And it got so popular that I had a mailing list and sort of things of people wanting to come. We could only ever get 40 people in a house, and I used to hijack people's houses to put these events on.
Yeah.
And it was such mad evenings, absolutely mad. Anything would happen. And so I went from there to start creating sort of shows in pubs and then started, like, you know, created theatre plays and all sorts of things since, and done festivals as well, got involved in festivals and got involved in like things like bringing French artists over from Brest in the past and stuff like that. And then, like, I was also working with a guy called Mike Green at the time, but unfortunately Mike has passed away now, bless his soul. But over the years, it's been about 20 odd people involved in Wonder Zoo one way or another. And then eventually we used to have it like Wonder Zoo Presents, and I was thinking, why am I doing Wonder Zoo Presents? So I just dropped PCQ Arts and we just changed over to Wonder Zoo because I thought it's a better name anyway and it's a bit more surreal. And over time we went from, like, we did a period where we were just doing poetry for a while, but I got a bit bored of that and I thought, no, I like all sorts of things. So basically what we've done is, at the heart of what we do is storytelling. So as long as it can take some form of word or storytelling, we don't mind what it is. I don't mind if you even get naked on stage and do a poem or do a piece or do a comedy. In fact, I've had Will from, everybody knows Will from Comedy Suspects. He's got down to his pants before.
Exactly.
But I'm still waiting for him to get down to being naked on stage.
I'll tell him.
So this is like a really quick brief bit of what we've been doing. At the core of what we do, we're all about, we work a lot with the Devil Cornwall Racial Equality Council and Pride in Plymouth. And so at the core of what we do, we're all about bringing community together and bringing people together and using art as a way to sort of say, you know, everyone can love one another, everyone can be friends with one another. And so, you know, we're all about, like, making change, positive change through activism, but through art.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. I love it. And so it was my first encounter with Wonder Zoo the other night, and I had a great time, and I thought the evening went really well. But importantly, I thought the audience were so friendly, and the location, the pub, everything was just like, this is such a great place to be and to experience that kind of, as you say, poetry and comedy and art. What are your plans, actually, Slane? What's so there's two of you, really, aren't there, in terms of...
Well, there's three directors.
Okay.
There's the silent director that no one sees, Claire Bower, because I think she's from The Invisible Man.
Okay.
She won't mind me saying that. But she's in a really cracking group called Franklin Street. They're a duo with her brother. So, that, you know, and then there's Queen Chi as well.
Queen Chi.
She's a really great artist and a great writer. And then there's me. But besides that, there's another seven or eight people that come on board whenever they want to come on board for different things. So Wonder Zoo is like a family, in a sense that there's so many different people involved. And people just come in and out where they want to come in and out, and that's what One Zoo is about. We're very much bottom up perspective. We're not a top down. We don't run things in a top down way in any sense. And so, you know, people just drift in and out, and they come and do what they want, and that's fine as far as we're concerned.
Sounds very like Sound Art, actually, because they have like this just open all hours feel to them that they just, you know, I remember connecting with somebody who was sort of examining bones over broadcasting. And I thought, I just love this. These are bones from the moor that somebody's examining and making sounds out of. And it's like Sound Art allows you to do whatever it is that really tickles your fancy. So today what tickles my fancy is Wonder Zoo. Can you tell me about your plans in terms of, so like, I want to come and see you again. How do I do that? What's coming on next?
So right now we've got, so leading up to Christmas and beyond, we've got four workshops which are kind of up in their charity shop in Mutley in Plymouth. So they're going to be safer streets because we've been connected. A lot of people keep coming to us saying, could you do workshops around safer streets? Because and we felt that was a really important thing to address those issues, especially for women. And, women and men should be equal in society. There should be this kind of divide that's going on, and women shouldn't feel unsafe. So we decided we're going to do those series of workshops. And then they're going to lead into a Christmas show. So whoever joins the workshops, whatever form they decide to engage in, and if they want to, it will lead to a Christmas show in the Shekinah charity shop, which will then be broadcast on Omen Radio, which is a local radio station. They're fantastic people, Omen Radio. They work a lot with disadvantaged people, so we really support them. And then we're going to do three pop-ups in Adelaide Park in the summer. So we're going to have poets, musicians, stalls, brick and brack, dance, and football as well. So. Wow. Yeah, from Hope. So we did them last year and they're really successful. We had like 1,500 people come through. So we're going to do them again this year.
Busy.
And then beyond that, we've got some shows we're planning to do sort of every couple of months. There'll be in Union Corner, which is on Union Street. And beyond that, we're also working with Respect Festival. So we've got a stage there this year. And we've got a stage at Union Street Party this year as well, which is in Stonehouse.
Yeah.
And we've got also 2 years worth of work with the Racial Equality Council, where we're archiving the Respect Festival, the box. And also we're looking at taking on a new historical project where we're going to work with the Global Minorities to create a project where I sit in the background, we get someone to come along and talk about the history of the city of Plymouth, but not from a white perspective, but from actually a global minorities perspective.
Absolutely.
And
brilliant.
Get someone to lead that project. And that for us is really important because that's a form of storytelling that doesn't get told in this city.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we're going. And also next year, we're going to have the festival back storytelling. It's going to be even bigger. So it's going to start, it's going to be like 7 days next year. It's going to be Monday to Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off with the first performance in a laundry shop. And I got the idea because I love those adverts from the 80s where the guy gets his top off, you know. And so I was going to do something similar to that. So it'd be eight people watching to start the festival and something might happen like that.
It's
around
absolutely
spoken word, so
I love it.
It could be quite saucy.
We like saucy.
And it ends on the Sunday in the Millennium Building for an actual rave because Millennium Building's taken over by Community Nudge Builders now, but it was closed for years. And it used to be a rave nightclub. So we thought about bringing the past back to the present because it's storytelling. And so we're going to conduct an actual full-scale 1980s rave, and you won't get in unless you're wearing 1980s clothing.
Well, I can tell you,
that's going to be like next year's Thai festival. We've met much more happening inside that besides that.
Well, you've got a lot on your plate. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the programme and sharing, you know, the news of Wonder Zoo and also really giving us an in-depth sort of scan on it. I loved it. You work really, really hard, all of you. I just want to applaud you and say thank you for all the hard work you do in Plymouth, Devon, and for kindly coming on our show today, Slade. Thank you. And all the very best. And if I can be any help at all, then you've got my email. But meantime, I'm going to play us out with Girls on Film, actually.
I like that.
Take care of yourself.
And you. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Well, it just leaves me to say thank you so much to Slane for coming on from Wonder Zoo. Sarah Louise Connolly, thank you for being our roaming reporter. And the Divine Inc., the Divine Julia Christine Wilson, thank you for being with us today. Laura Horton, all the very best with Breathless. And your show going out to Edinburgh. That's coming on to stages in Plymouth, Plymouth Theatre Royal, on the 20th through to the 23rd, so do get your tickets. Meantime, we'll be back next week. Thank you to Martin for all the support and love, and get better soon to anyone who's suffering with the virus. Loads of love. See you soon.